Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. This is Michael Anderson, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7, your community radio station. And this is the Hole in the Bucket program, KBOO's a radio show that deals with housing, homelessness, poverty, and the issues that relate to them. So on the show tonight, we are going to be talking about a particular media event that's going to be coming to town. A lot of times on KBOO, we talk about particularly the corporate media and what the corporate media lacks as far as, you know, be it integrity or doing the right stories, on and on and on. At the same time, we have a great local print media outlet here in Portland, Street Roots, a newspaper. And they are the host of an upcoming conference called the North American Street Newspaper Association Conference, which is going to be in town on July 26th to the 29th at the Ondine Building at Portland State University. So to talk about the conference, I have in the studio with me tonight two folks from Street Roots, Joanne Zuhl and Israel Baer. Good evening.
Hi. Thank you, Michael.
Hello.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. This was a last minute one, so I hope that I help you as much as you helped me. So the North American Street Newspaper Association Conference. We talked a little bit about the association on the show about 5 months ago. Israel, you came on and talked about the growing movement and collective activity of Street Roots, not just in North America, but really across the globe. And this is a convention, a gathering here in town to advance that collective approach.
Yeah, that's correct. We're going to have we have 37 member papers throughout North America, and we're going to have about 20 representatives from newspapers and journalists from other media outlets, professionals that are writing a book, actually, on the street newspaper movement. And we're gathering to work on a collective agreement with the North American Street Newspaper Association and the International Network of Street Papers. And we're also going to be focusing on guerrilla journalism, how to create a design that your readers will love, and it will help vendors. We're also going to be working a lot on the business model and how to successfully run a nonprofit. So,
before we get into some of the more specifics about the conference, just a little bit for some of our listeners who may have missed that show a while, talk a little bit about, Joanne, if you would, the North American Street Newspaper Association and the International Association, just to give people a little background.
Well, both organizations are about 10 to 12 years old. The North America Street Newspaper Association, as the name suggests, obviously takes in North America and has been a regional network that has operated as a separate entity for many years. The International Network of Street Papers was created in 1994, which brought together, obviously, basically everybody who wasn't in NASNA, essentially. In the past 2 years, though, these two organizations have been working much more aligned with each other, as they should be, because they do share a similar mission. They do have some crossover membership. The International Network has, with NASNA, including NASNA members now, which I should back up, actually joined INSP in 2005. Altogether, we're looking at about 80 newspapers in 24 or 30 countries, and we're talking about 30-some million circulation from very polished glossies in London and Australia to some very basic, simple newspapers. And then you've got a wealth of papers in the middle, such as Street Roots operating here in Portland.
Now, and Street Roots is a member of both of these associations.
Correct.
All right. So, Israel, we're talking a little bit about what the conference is going to be about, what type of topics are covered. I'd like to get into that, but I'd also like to talk to you. So who is this conference focused for? Is this something that any of our listeners could come to, or is this something that's really more of a gathering of trade professionals?
I think it's a gathering of trade professionals, but we all are also very open to the idea of being able to include other small media in the conference. The workshops that will be being given do a lot of strategic planning, capacity building work for small newspapers, knowing that we're all short of resources. And it also works with the idea of doing different kinds of journalism to be able to attract readers and reflect your mission. So we would definitely invite other smaller newspapers throughout Portland to be able to take part in the conference. And if they would like to be a part of that, they can contact Street Roots.
And the number for Street Roots?
It's 503-228-5657.
So one of the what you were just talking about in terms of a major strain of workshops and attention is to essentially capacity building or business models for street newspapers. You know, when we critique the corporate media often, the answers that we get back from them are, oh, well, the market is driving us for these stories. We're a business. We have to do it this way. I imagine if you don't choose to go down the path of corporate media, you still got to figure out the business model. Talk about some of the challenges that you've experienced at Street Roots that you hear about from other street papers, and what will the workshops help people put together to address some of those challenges?
Well, you know, the street newspaper is a unique model because we're an alternative media outlet on one hand, and on the other hand, we're an empowerment project for poor people. So the idea, I think a lot of street newspapers fall into a pattern of applying for money and marketing themselves as purely kind of a homeless newspaper or a homeless incorporated program, when the idea is that you're an alternative media and an empowerment project. And so what Street Roots and a lot of other newspapers are finding out is that we can be a professional newspaper for the community at large, and that much more benefits the vendor because the vendor is actually able to make more money and put more money into their pockets because we have a larger readership. Saying that, you know, newspapers that are working with people on the streets oftentimes have to deal with a lot of the political dynamics around homelessness, the way funding goes, where do you get your funding? And Street Roots really tries to take an approach where we are a reader-supported newspaper. About a third of our budget comes from supporters, individual donors, and a third from foundations. And the bulk of those foundations, we're finding out, are actually foundations that are media foundations. And so the idea is that we want to stay free of kind of outside of the box of homelessness and the way the homelessness funding works. because oftentimes with, you know, with the carrot, there's the stick, and you have to do a pony show for a lot of government agencies. And we really feel like our strong point is being able to be a media outlet and to put money directly into the hands of poor people.
So what are some of the type of workshops or teaching tools that will be at the conference that will help other newspapers look at some of these issues and challenges?
Well, we're very fortunate. We have a great group of people and volunteers here from the community, from other media, and then from educational aspects who are helping us with this. And what we've done is divide the workshops. There's two sides of it, as we were talking about. You've got the business side and you've got the newspaper side, and they have to work together. You have to have a great newspaper product to actually sell your product and put money into the hands of the people you're working with in your community. And at the same time, you have to stay viable as an organization. Often what I think street newspapers get launched because they are the sparks of a passion and, you know, of a flame of activism. And then the newspaper business is learned secondary and the fundraising business is learned secondary. So what we're trying to do from the fundraising side is, of course, strategic planning, business management, really connecting with the supporters in your community with the notion really that if they believe in your mission, they will support your cause. On the other side of it, with the editorial side of it, with the newspaper side, we have the folks from, we have Amy Ruiz from and Scott Moore from the Mercury, who are helping run a course on fair and biased, about balancing advocacy and journalism. We have Nick Budnick from Portland Tribune is going to be coming and teaching guerrilla journalism. We have myself, I'm going to be basically just facilitating a roundtable of the papers to come together and present their newspapers and really look at the papers in a critique and looking at all of us just contributing to what is appealing about the paper, what we can do better. Because, you know, so many of these papers, and until recently I would say ourselves, you know, basically come into work and they have two sticks and a large rock to put out a newspaper. So they're struggling with resources, with staffing, with equipment, but yet they still manage to put out a very important and significant product. So we want them to be able to use what they've got, their tools, and what we know is just basically best practices to improve on that, to really build on what they already know and go forward.
So, I like it. It sounds like in some ways almost like you would hear like with a poetry workshop or a writer's workshop where you're bringing people together all, you know, with a similar trade, as it were, that then in some ways have the space and freedom to chop up each other's stuff, their own stuff, throw it up on the wall, look at it from a different perspective. Is that part of what's going to go on?
I would hope there's no chopping involved, but I would like to see people.
Well, that was poetry. That was metaphorical chopping.
I'm sorry. I would like to see people looking seriously outside of what they're stuck in a rut doing. I mean, that's what happens with papers. You know, you get comfortable with what you're doing, and you can always fall back into a scarcity idea of that's all I've got, so that's all I can do. And I think there's a lot to be learned from what other newspapers have done. And not only that, just in a design and maybe a content packaging idea, but really looking at how other newspapers have overcome the obstacle of not having a photographer, not having a team of reporters, not having those resources. From our end, we've really been able to connect with the community. We've got a great volunteer photographer. We now have a freelance journalist who's working for us. We have put together an editorial committee of volunteers, and you find that the passion for the newspaper, you know, extends far beyond just the people working at the newspaper. It's in the community that they have this newspaper out there that really represents them and can be their voice, which is often why we get pretty disgusted with other larger for-profit shareholding media, because you often don't feel that it represents your voice. Well, we're trying to do the opposite.
So very much in the spirit of how we do here at KBOO.
And to add to that, I think that we've really tried to take the idea that a lot of activist newspapers have a stereotype on them. Oftentimes they're poorly laid out. They oftentimes don't take into account the different nuances that journalism offers, and they're able to be discredited purely because their paper honestly doesn't look that very good. So we take that stuff very seriously, and if we're able to be a professionally designed newspaper while also being a community activist voice covering hard issues and taking a stand on different things, we're drawing a whole different readership into the fray and being able to educate them on things that they would normally not even pick up because oftentimes, again, a lot of newspapers just don't pay attention to those things, and they worry more about the voice than they do the way a product looks. So.
What is guerrilla journalism? That's come up a couple times. Well,
I think Nick Mudink is going to be doing a workshop on guerrilla journalism, and he was intern under the muckraking journalist
Jack Anderson,
and he has worked at small newspapers most of his career. And so he really comes at it from a position of when you're the underdog, you have a certain advantages to what you're doing. So being able to take that that essence of being the underdog and being a newspaper and what you can do with that.
One of the things that strikes me about really, I guess, a lot of the nature of this conference is the way it takes advantage of peer-to-peer learning. That's something in the professional background that I'm in the community development world, with similar resource restraints, a similar feeling of when you're trying to run this dynamic organization that's supposed to produce housing, but you also got to keep your employees paid, keep the nonprofit rolling, all that stuff. A lot of times you feel isolated, like you're out on an island. And I think one of the things that my organization serves is we help those nonprofits find a forum where they can come together and share, oh, this is how we got over that hurdle. Or, hey, listen to this new idea we're going to pilot. And I think that's a model of real strength. And it occurs to me, and I'm very interested to segue into, we have this conference coming to Portland, and we'll wrap up and talk a little bit more about that. But Joanne, you just came back from an international conference that was a similar peer-to-peer model of street papers for these papers from around the world.
Right. That's the International Network of Street Papers I was mentioning earlier. They meet once a year. And in early June, they met in Poznan, Poland. And we had about 40 newspapers there, all gathered for 4 days to look at just what you were talking about, that peer-to-peer effort. It was also a consolidation effort to really bring together people about a common cause. And what we did, we produced an anti-poverty declaration, which was a part exercise as far as getting people on the same page, and also a part of declaration to say, you know, street papers are working and they're doing incredible work in various countries, all different kinds of models, from sticking with a street paper to moving on to providing schools for the children of the vendors, to providing mentoring programs, to hiring practices. One of the papers is going to be starting a hotel on the similar model, nonprofit, and it's job training and recruitment. So there's just amazing things happening around the world through these papers. So it was pretty incredible. It's 4 intense days of learning so much and learning great people and finding that you know, we've all it's all been done before, and we're all just at different stages of going through it. So
where are they opening the hotel?
That's going to be in Germany.
Wow, that sounds like a big endeavor, mixing two very different worlds. So how did people communicate? Was English?
Fortunately for myself, at least, English was the common language. Most of the people there do speak English. There were translators. We had a contingent from Russia, from a newspaper there, that were listening to. It was interpreted into Polish and then into Russian. So one way or another, it gets done. It's a little mini United Nations.
Wow, that sounds very, very amazing.
Fascinating.
So one of the things that when you were on here 5 or 6 months ago that we talked about is, as a result of this network between street papers, there's new opportunities opening up. I think you talked about the listserv at that point, or your own news service where you're putting stuff over a wire. But there's also been some opportunities. You talked about a story in Brazil where some people who were homeless were dying in a repeated fashion, and the Brazilian street newspaper, or one of them, I think there's several in Brazil, if my memory serves correct, sort of got the word out to the other street newspapers, let's start creating a buzz because everybody's ignoring it here locally. And that made a real difference. Are there other stories like that are going on in the international newspapers?
Well, we did learn at this conference coming out of Buenos Aires in Argentina that it's a common occurrence for there to be police shootings and the victim to be indigenous people in the community. almost every other day is what the editor there told me. And it's a real serious issue. Nothing's being done about it, and nobody's being held accountable, either through the government or through the police agency. And that's not an unheard-of story throughout some South American countries. So this is an issue that we want to bring up, and I think it's going to be a campaign that the INSP is going to look at as far as that kind of accountability and what's happening in countries where there is it's blatant racism happening out and people are getting killed over it. So fortunately, through this network of street papers, we have a voice to deliver this. We have a voice to deliver it, not through a reporter flying down from Washington, D.C. to cover the story, but through the people right there on the streets in Buenos Aires. And also we have the Street News Service, which we haven't mentioned yet, that we're very proud of to be a part of. That has contributors from newspapers around the world, and basically it's a news source for all papers to use in the street paper community to be able to pull stories off. So a story can come out of Buenos Aires, and it can be picked up and covered along with photos and interviews in all the newspapers, and that's how that gets organized. We have an agreement through this with Reuters as well, which posts some stories on it. So they're working with us. Interpress, which is an enormous social justice news service that you can check out online for people who are interested. They are interested in working with us and contributing stories and getting involved. So it's really building a momentum, and with that, we have such a capacity to deliver worldwide campaigns.
Yeah, and I would add to that, to a more local thing. I think it gives individual local newspapers power. In the idea, I think you could use the 10-year plan to end homelessness as one example. If one newspaper throughout the country is covering the 10-year plan and doing point counterpoints with different individuals about different things happening with the administration with homelessness, one paper oftentimes can be discredited and kind of just brushed under the rug. But through the network, we're able to be sending that same message in 37 communities throughout the country. And all of a sudden, it's not just one newspaper messaging that idea. It's 37 newspapers. So with these different things, we can take local efforts that are happening and affecting us out on the streets every day that normally would go kind of just unheard, but by publishing them, we're able to draw the eyes and ears of the people upstairs.
And I think some of the coverage that you all did of New Orleans and the recovery around that, some of those news stories you got from sources down there, am I correct in that?
That's correct. We worked with community organizers on the ground in New Orleans to be able to.
Right, because again, as much as there was so much extensive coverage of that event, I in a lot of ways felt that the story that you guys did was at least the best one that I read here in the media. I mean, obviously there was all sorts of coverage on the web and stuff, but to me that was another great example. And, thinking about it at the start of the show, I was saying about some of the challenges that we see with corporate media and sometimes the monotone messages that come out of that. But I guess the flip side is, as much as there's that consolidation, the same technology that allows for that consolidation also opens doors for the street newspapers and other outlets.
Yeah, and I think, the readership is ripe for it. They want it. They're looking for something else, and they don't need it to be a one-stop shop package. They don't need, we probably will not be having a sports section for a while. But in the meantime, people are very invested in our newspaper and our coverage. So, I think that's going to grow.
Is there something going on in the news besides sports?
Right.
Sorry there. Okay. So we have about 5 or 6 more minutes to talk here today. And there's a couple other things that I wanted to get to. One is that there's some exciting new changes coming at Street Roots. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about it?
Oh, I can talk about the project-oriented stuff with the organization, and then Joanne can talk about the newspaper a little bit. But for people that are familiar with Street Roots, we have the Rose City Resource Guide inside the newspaper. And we're going to be reformatting the Rose City resources to be a pocket-sized resource guide for people on the streets so that they're able to have the resources and carry them around. What we found over time that a lot of our readership is actually affluent, and a lot of the resources were kind of dead space. So we've worked with a group of community partners to be able to reformat the resources in a way that will benefit people on the streets. And also with
– just so for – if there are any listeners out there who don't regularly get street roots, what Israel's referring to is that part. It's usually in the middle of the paper. They'll have the list of where you can get food, where you can stay, health services, all sorts of things that for people on the street, it makes it simple for them because it's a one place they can go to find out what they might be needing or looking for.
Absolutely. It's the most most extensive resource list for poor people in Portland. So
And regularly updated,
that's correct. And then the other thing that we're doing along with that in the same kind of vein is we're going to be putting out a wallet-size Know Your Rights guide for people on the streets concerning laws that affect them. Most notorious, it will be the public nuisance laws that affect people on the streets in a way to educate them and mobilize them in a way that they know what their rights are. So we'll be putting that out to the people as well. And then we have some exciting things coming with the newspaper as well.
Right. So with the resource guide being developed into a separate project, that's going to free us up with 4 open pages in the middle of the newspaper. We're not going to go down in size. So we're looking at filling up, being able to provide more news and really connecting with more international stories, more national, and also being able to perhaps bring in more youth projects in the paper. Many different ways that can be developed, but it's a great opportunity because we're often very tight with space on that newspaper. In other works that we're looking at, we have formed a partnership not too long ago. I mean, we've always had a good relationship with KBOO Radio, but we recently solidified that partnership with regular newscasts every other week for the evening news. And with that, we're now going to be working with One Economy, which is an organization here in town that works to bridge the digital divide, to use the cliche, for providing not only access but also integration with digital technology and the internet with low-income folks. They have a website called 24/7, Town Hall 24/7. So through this triad, we're going to be producing some pieces not only for KBOO News, but we'll also go on as a podcast through this website. And then also link through our news center. So on our website at www.streetroots.org. So through this, we are really kind of able to, I think we're going to be doing a lot more with our news. We're going to really develop a stronger network for people in the community to find alternative information, to find alternative news about social justice, civil rights, and the issues facing low-income people and all of us in the community. So it's really exciting to have that relationship developing.
And you're staffing up too. You're adding some new folks.
We have a new freelance reporter, Matthew Deshane, who is making his debut in this newspaper. So you're going to want to be sure to pick that up on Friday. So I'm very delighted for that.
And we have a full-time office manager resource specialist that we just hired. So we doubled our staff this month. So
excellent, excellent. Yeah. And I would wager to guess that both of you are very happy to have help on both counts, another journalist in the office and then someone else to help keep the organization flow.
So it's allowing us to be here right now.
Oh, good, good. Well, because otherwise, who knows? Our KBOO listeners would just be listening to me talking on and on. What about, is there any stories that are coming up in Street Roots that our listeners might want to be looking out for, paying attention to? I know we've had the ongoing coverage of the PPI, but are there any longer stories that you're working on coming up?
Well, we'll continue to stay on top of PPI. We also, in this issue, we're looking at just kind of the status of the green, the environmental movement, the forest preservation movement, the history that Portland has a long history of. We're going to be looking at the IPR now that it's finally going to be reviewed by the city. That's the independent police review system for police. And again, that carries over to the accountability of private security. And we're also going to continue with our great columnists between Alejandro Corral and the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center, mm-hmm. Marvin Mitchell, Ruth Kovach, building on that and incorporating more voices in the newspaper.
Well, exciting times, exciting times. So if you don't already have a Street Roots vendor that is your favorite, you should make one today. There's a lot of great stuff in the paper, and there's, I think, bigger than that. There's a vision that comes not with Street Roots, but obviously at this point across North America and across the globe of presenting a great independent voice and then also being a real model that gives people an avenue up and out that is filled with dignity instead of making you sort of kowtow to get through. So I really appreciate the work that both of you guys do. Thank you so much for coming in at the last minute. Any last things about the conference coming up that you want to?
No, if people would like to attend, just call Street Roots at 503-228-5657 and buy your newspaper from the vendor because they're out there working and they're out there 6 and 8 and 10 hours a day right now in 100-degree weather. So go buy your Street Roots and read it.
Yeah, and buy him a bottle of water. For
Absolutely. Buy him two.
Buy him two. All right. So thank you very much, guys, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Thank you, Michael.
La paix pour tout le monde. Politicien, moyen, la mer, aïe, la mer, aïe.
Welcome back to Hole in the Bucket. This is Michael Anderson, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is your community radio station. So we are going to use the last portion of the show here to talk about the Oregon legislative session that just concluded. As we talked about many times over the past 16, 18 months on this show, the Statewide Housing Alliance, a now almost three-year-old coalition of housing advocates, poverty advocates, cities, counties, housing authorities, social service agencies from around the state have been working in the state legislature to try to get Oregon engaged and invested in addressing the housing needs of Oregon. Now, you know, of course, the state of Oregon has a housing and community services department that does work around the state already. But historically, most of those funds have come from the federal level, and the state has acted more as a pass-through. And as a matter of fact, the state has roughly every two years, every biennium, as they think about it legislatively, put in somewhere between $6 and $8.5 million dedicated to affordable housing, which, speaking quite frankly, is hardly a thing, hardly a thing. So this past legislative session, the Housing Alliance had a very ambitious agenda, which is to increase that $6 to $8 million per biennium up to $100 million per biennium. And we got real, real, real close, but we didn't quite get there yet. And so what I wanted to do for the listeners who I have been informing about the process down in Salem, I wanted to give you an update about what happened. And then certainly if we have any callers who would like to call in and ask some questions, be my guest. The number, as always, 503-231-8187. Liam, I hope I didn't catch you off guard there saying callers. Okay. Thank you very much, Liam Delta, that is engineering tonight and helping out a great deal. So the most prominent bill that we were working on was a document recording fee. And what a document recording fee is, very simply, is when a title or deed has a change to it. So like when you sell your house, there's the change of name on who owns the title of the deed. There would be an increase to the current fee assessed when you get that processed by the counties. Right now it's $11. We wanted to increase it $15, and that $15 increase to the title change would have generated about $38 million that could be used statewide to address affordable housing needs, to help people get off the streets out of homelessness, to help working families, seniors, and people with disabilities with incomes being outpaced by the market, to get their foot in the door, at least have the stability that comes with a place you can afford. But unfortunately, the document recording fee in the last 3 days of the session went down. There was a vote on the House floor, and because the document recording fee is a, quote, tax, we needed to get a double majority to get it through. So we needed 36 total votes to get the document recording fee to be reality and go to the governor's desk for law. We got 33 votes, and what happened is essentially partisan politics. We had been working for the past 20 months very much billing the document recording fee and what we were trying to do with the funds as a nonpartisan issue. In other words, who in their right mind is opposed to having working families being able to afford a place to live or have retirees be able to pay for their apartment and still afford medicine, etc.? And we had made a lot of inroads. Very interestingly enough, there were prominent Republicans across the state who were very interested and actually had made various pledges and promises of support. And as a matter of fact, going into 2 weeks to go in the session, we had 45 votes. We had 12 Republicans in the House that were going to come on board, and they would have passed what would have been the only tax of the session. But on the Friday before the legislative session ended, we had the passage of several very important transportation bills, transportation that would, say, create light rail from Milwaukee to Portland, light rail within Portland, and a parking garage near light rail in Hillsboro. So all important things for transportation, environment, and other in the metro area. Well, the House Republicans thought that transportation spending constitutes a pork spending. In other words, a project that's just a financial giveaway but serves no real purpose. And they decided, because they were angry at that, that they would go against, frankly, their own principles of supporting this housing bill and vote it down because it was a tax. So that was something that was extraordinarily disappointing for the thousands of folks across the state who had worked very hard, again, across the aisles, trying not to get into the various name-calling. But unfortunately, a partisan politics prevailed, which is where I'm going to make my first side comment of the night. You know, it's interesting because oftentimes progressives, and certainly those who also identify as Democrats, are told that we need to end the partisan bickering, as if like it's this even-handed discussion of everybody's bickering, we just can't get along. What I like to think of it more is, if there's a bully on your chest and he's punching you in the face and saying, "Don't punch me back," you're keeping this fight going. It's not quite fair to put the onus of let's end the partisan bickering to the progressives and the Democrats. I mean, frankly, I guess what I would say is this particular bill would help people who right now are having to live in very, very horrible environments, make really unconscionable choices between things like food, medicine, being able to pay rent, being able to pay the bills, not to mention stuff like getting your kid a birthday present or other basics like that. And yet, it got subsumed by this partisan environment. And this was after we made umpteen efforts like, we're not going to make this a partisan issue, da, da, da. I guess what my point is let us not be fooled by a bully sitting on our chest, punching us in the face, saying, "Don't punch me back," and then we can get along. Because I think that's a little bit about what's been happening at the state level politically. And I think we can see some similar federal parallels. That said, so I've talked about the big disappointment. We actually had the best session down in Salem in the history of affordable housing. We got $28 million in new resources for the next 2 years, bringing up the total that the state's going to put in the next 2 years to between 34 and 36 million. So in other words, even though we lost this permanent source of funding, this source of funding that would have brought Oregon's total contribution to the housing challenge to about 75-80 million per biennium, we still achieved more than advocates had ever achieved before in Salem. And that's a really important thing for our KBOO listeners to know, and to also apply to the different endeavors that we may all individually be working on. In other words, we saw progress on what had formerly been an ignored issue at the state level, housing and homelessness, that we have never seen before. We had the governor up front talking about it in his budget. We had the Joint Ways and Means Committee put the Housing Alliance, $100 million for housing, in their top priorities for the budget. And when the document recording fee actually went down, we had in papers across the state, leaders talking about this is the unfinished business. We're going to come back in 2008. So I say that to say that despite the fact that the major bill that we talked about on this show and that we urged you to call in on didn't pass, we still made unprecedented progress. And this is very important because when we look at the huge hole that we're in around housing or homelessness or poverty, there's going to be no silver bullet or no magical stroke that is going to turn the tables on where we are. There's going to be concerted effort, not getting put down by defeats, and continue to come back and build on what we have. With the risk of me being extremely just the talking head yapping on the radio, which is never necessarily the best to listen to, I want to run down specifically what some of those accomplishments were. And again, if there's callers out there who have questions about what happened in the state legislature around housing, you can always call in at 503-231-8187. So what's the good news? What happened that we have to celebrate? First, we had the passage of the Housing and Community Service budget, where we got $26 million infused into that budget to bring it up to about $34 million available for affordable housing development, preservation, homeless services, vouchers, services that will help people with mental illness and other disabilities succeed in housing. We have a tremendous new influx of funds to deal with those problems. Again, we are not all the way there, but that is, when we look at what had been put in before, we increased the volume of funds available for housing and homelessness by nearly 6 times. Another thing that we did that we were very happy about is we expanded the Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which is a very, very efficient tax credit that in order to qualify for the tax credit, you have to show that you're dropping people's rents by the exact amount that you get for credit. So this is a great tool in situations where you're talking about families earning minimum wages or seniors living on very limited, meager retirements. This Affordable Housing Tax Credit is going to create more affordable options for those folks. But better yet, what we did is we expanded the rules of how that tax credit can be used so it can be applied to the preservation of manufactured home parks. One of the things that we've seen across the state is people living in manufactured home parks have just had the carpet yanked from under them. These are people who own a manufactured home or a mobile home, as they're more often known. And but they own it on someone else's land. And when that owner says, well, I want to do something new with the land, there isn't really boo that the tenant can say. They need to vacate the property. And unfortunately for them, a manufactured home is not mobile. It doesn't move. And as a matter of fact, that they almost in all instances lose all the equity that they were trying to raise through this purchase of the manufactured home. So what we did with this Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is we expanded the use of the tax credit so we can try a pilot project that they've tried in the state of New Hampshire that allows park residents to purchase the parks. In other words, so that the manufactured home park becomes a co-op. And we think that this is a really great tool that we need to figure out how to get going in Oregon. A lot of times in manufactured home parks, you have a tremendous community. You have people who have been living there for 15, 20 years, again, oftentimes in retirement, but many times a lot of working families there too. And this gives a chance for people who make a community to own the community and to protect their own investments and also to really cultivate and grow the sense of community that, you know, when you read the stories about the manufactured home parks closing, people take a huge financial hit, but they also lose their social networks. And this is something that we hope to get online using this new tax credit to be able to bring some of the potential of doing these collectively owned manufactured home parks right here in Oregon. Another bill that we passed that we were very excited about had to do with condominium conversion. I know if you drive anywhere in Portland, you see this apartment building that didn't look so great a couple years ago. Then it got a brand new paint job, a little landscaping, maybe some copper caps on the fence going around it, a new fancy name, and all of a sudden it's condo selling for, you know, $180,000, $190,000. Well, every time a condo is converted, those renters are tossed out on their duff. Now, this is America. Property rights trump human rights, whether we like it or not, and I don't like it a bit. But what it means is we're not going to be able to do something, at least in the immediate, where we could limit private owners from making that decision to make their apartment building into a condominium. But what we did in the state legislature is we put in place strong enforcement mechanisms that would say that the people who live in those apartments need to get a minimum 120 days notice. And furthermore, landlords can no longer use things such as the 30-day no-cause eviction or huge rent raises to chase tenants out of the apartment before the 120 days. What we're seeing across the city and really across the state is that oftentimes, even though people legally had their 20 days, that the owners were using various other techniques to sort of usher them out quickly, you know, get the construction workers in, turn it around, make a buck. And what we did is now if owners don't give the full 120 days notice, or further, if they give a rent raise within a calendar year backwards or a 30-day no cause within a calendar year backwards of when it converts to condominium, that those tenants are eligible to collect 6 months' rent in damages. And, you know, for our listeners out there, you know, there's a lot of great laws in the books that say you can do this and you can do that. But in my opinion, if there isn't some kind of penalty attached to it, that a lot of people will just, you know, flaunt their own will in the face of the law. But when all of a sudden you have to pay tenants 6 months' rent, then you're going to stop these kind of shenanigans. So we feel very positive about that condo conversion bill. There was another manufactured home bill. I know I talked about the tax credit, but it did similar things to the condominium conversion bill in terms of really legislating the type of notice that landlords need to give if they're going to plan to move a park. And then because of that really difficult area of that people who live in manufactured home parks own their manufactured home, there is something in the legislation that we got through where residents of manufactured home parks are eligible for payments of either $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000, depending on what their moving expenses is and what their other financial losses are involved with the park closure. This is another thing we feel very good about. It's rough enough if your community gets destroyed and pulled apart right in front of you, but then to also take the financial hit. And to be clear, what was happening to people is they were losing all the equity they put in their manufactured home because they couldn't move it. But worse yet, they were having to pay to have it moved and demolished itself. So not only were they losing money for something they purchased, but they were then having to pay someone else to get rid of it and demolish it. Really, quite a disgusting outcome when you see that the owners of these manufactured home parks are making just a wild killing when they turn one of these manufactured home parks over, usually into McMansions or some other sort of higher-end commercial mixed-use housing development. So we were also very excited about that. And then also we had some exciting work where we didn't get as far as we wanted, but around something that's called inclusionary zoning. And inclusionary zoning is something that is currently not allowed or illegal in the state of Oregon because home builders have been opposed to it, and they got a preemption at the state legislature that says nowhere in Oregon can we try inclusionary zoning. But inclusionary zoning is a super tool that takes some of the momentum and financial wherewithal of the private developers who, you know, obviously they're in business and making a lot of money as we see all this growth and construction around the region. It takes some of their profits that they're making and generates it back into affordable housing. And it can happen by a requirement of saying, Mr. Developer, if you'd like to build in our town, the requirement is that 5% of your units have to be affordable at such and such a level, and you just have to work that into your business plan. So in other words, there's no public dollars put in. The private, as they're doing this larger development, as a public benefit, they have to do these affordable units. This is something that they do across the country. It's extremely reasonable. Obviously, home builders and developers will tell you, well, we don't like it. It hurts our bottom line. But what I'll tell you is when we look at the prices that new apartments and condominiums are renting or selling for, and the amount of money that developers are walking away with, based on infrastructure that you and I and other taxpayers pay for, it's very appropriate that they put a little bit into the common kitty. And if we know we're having housing challenges around the region, I mean, you look at a place like Wilsonville, it's very hard to find, a place. If you work in Wilsonville, you're working in a service job. If you have a service job, you're not making enough money to live in Wilsonville. That's messed up. We have people commuting all around the region. Inclusionary zoning is a tool that would say, private developer, you can do your work in Wilsonville or wherever, but you got to give back a little bit to Wilsonville. You got to make Wilsonville still work for Wilsonville. So that's a brief rundown. What I will say is for our listeners, if you're interested in finding out more about the Oregon Housing Alliance in the last legislative session, you can go to the website www.OregonHousingAlliance.org. That's one word, OregonHousingAlliance.org. There's a run-through of all these bills with link to the exact language of the bills if you want to know more. And then also, it's a way to get engaged in the Housing Alliance. I'll tell you what, I was one of the folks who helped form the Housing Alliance 3 years ago. And one of our principles is, hey, we're not getting together for one legislative idea. We're not getting together for one legislative session. We want to build a movement. We know the work that we have in front of us is probably at least a decade, and we got to start now. So we're 3 years in. We've had more victories than we've ever had at the state level on affordable housing. And I tell you, we're only going to do better in years to come. So you can get involved. If you want to just call me and find out more about it, you can reach me at 503-335-9884. That's, again, I'm Michael Anderson, 503-335-9884. And for all the hole-in-the-bucket listeners who did call your senator and did call your representative and said we need more housing opportunity, thank you very much. We're going to have you call again next session, and next session we're going to have even bigger wins to report on. So, a lot of talking from me. Thank you for all of you who tuned into the show. Thank you for Israel and Joanne from Street Roots for doing the first part, for Liam for your engineering tonight, and to the listening audience out there, keep cool. We're going to have some – it's going to be hard to keep cool when you got the hot tracks of Jamela following this show, but keep cool anyway, somehow, some way. This is your community radio station, 90.7 KBOO FM. This is Hole in the Bucket. Good night. Keep on rocking.